This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. Today, the Beaton Institute. We'll talk with archivist Jane Arnold. And on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall speaks with author Blaine Henshaw about his new book, The Peddlers. That's coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The Beaton Institute at Cape Breton University has been around for some time, helping people research and connect with their roots. Recently, a Cape Breton University student's research found a family connection with U.S. President Abe Lincoln. Jane Arnold is an archivist at the Beaton Institute, and she spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
Can you explain how the Beaton Institute has become a hub for amateur and professional researchers and the resources that are available there to help people navigate their way through the enormous amount of collections on site?
Well, we're located in the Cultural Heritage Center of Cape Breton University. And so we're located very close to the art gallery down the Great Hall. And you turn right, and when you walk through the doors, you'll be greeted with a fairly expansive reading room. And so that's where your visit will begin, and you'll meet either myself or our archival reference assistant, Anna McNeil. And so we offer all kinds of services, depending on what type of research you're interested in. So we serve students here at Cape Breton University. We serve visiting scholars and students, faculty, of course, but community members as well, and people, you know, who are just interested in archives and Cape Breton history who may want to visit. Also, we have, you know, engineers and professionals, artists, authors, all using our services. So as far as what to expect, we want to welcome, you know, everyone who comes in and then get you oriented to how you maybe go about finding the materials. And so we usually do an introduction to our digital archive, which is online, but also we still use a card catalog. And so Anna or myself generally would help you learn how to use those. And if there's specific questions, sometimes we can narrow down the search for you and give you some suggestions on collections or where you might be able to more quickly find the material you're looking for.
When did you and your colleagues and predecessors start the project of collecting, as it says on the website, historically significant records of Cape Breton University? And not to mention, it's the island's central location for local, regional, national, and global research. It seems like a huge responsibility to preserve the cultural history of Cape Breton Island.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. It began alongside the development and the advocacy for Xavier Junior College and then for basically CBU and its predecessors. So, CCB and UCCB to have, their own, Cape Breton's own university. And Sister Margaret Beaton was instrumental, as well as D.F. Campbell and Monsignor McClellan, the first presidents of Xavier and CBU. They recognized the need. They were worried. Basically, Sister Margaret was from Inverness County and a Gaelic speaker. And so initially there was worry about the loss of Gaelic and Celtic culture on the island, and that's where it began. But it quickly grew to include many different ethnic groups here on the island and, you know, a vast cross-section of our heritage and our history. So it began in 1957, and it would have started out as a fairly small archive out of the library. Sister Margaret Beaton was the librarian at Xavier Junior College, and she also retrained as an archivist. And so she began collecting archival collections and actually going out into the field and doing field work to collect interviews. And that's part of one of our most significant and extraordinary collections here at the archive, which is our Sound and Moving Image collection. And so in 1957, we were one of the main institutes that developed at Xavier Junior College and then continued to grow once we moved as the College of Cape Breton, University College of Cape Breton, and now Cape Breton University.
You mentioned the sound and moving image collection and the vision that Sister Margaret Beaton had. What exactly is that collection, and why is it so important to better understand our local history?
Sure. The Sound and Moving Image Collection refers to most of our audio and video that has been collected. Now, we do have audio and video that are included in other collections, but this is the main repository, and we do have it listed online on our digital archive, beatoninstitute.com. We have an Excel file, and so if you type in Sound and Moving Image Collection into our search bar on the Digital Archive, you'll see musician Doug McPhee come up. We have an image of him, and down below is actually an Excel file which lists the majority of the content that's in that collection. And what would be held in it are some of the earliest commercial recordings, Cape Breton recordings. You would find recordings of events, house parties, a lot of traditional Cape Breton music, and as well, the oral histories that are held there are really fantastic. So those would include languages from all different ethnic groups, so Polish, Eastern European, Ukrainian. We have Gaelic represented as well. French, of course, our Acadian communities. And the oral histories are very special because obviously they're capturing moments in time, and they're often, recording people who are no longer with us. So that's what's so special about it. So you get this first-person narrative. And we often recommend these to researchers and students. A good portion of the collection has been digitized, and you can contact staff to receive, copies of the recording for research purposes. So we work with researchers all the time, and, I always recommend exploring the Sound and Moving Image Collection because it is so rich in information and, of course, music. So if you are interested in Cape Breton music, it's really essential that you take a look or come visit us and talk to us about accessing the collection.
Do you think the Sound and Moving Image Collection can lend support to the notion that Sydney may be one of the best early examples of multiculturalism in all of North America? And if you consider the people who came here from all over the world to work in the mines or at the steel plant, and just one example being, if you take a drive through Whitney Pier, you can see different churches available for people who live here from all walks of life.
I think so. I mean, we were, we were growing up alongside a lot of other cities that were going through an industrial boom. So, other areas that would have steel and coal would also, have a very multi ethnic population, but our steel and coal industries began quite early, so I think you're safe to say that, especially in the coal mining areas, you would have, pockets of Eastern European and Italian. African Americans came up, that's a really interesting story, to work in the steel plant. Many of them ended up leaving because the conditions weren't as advertised, but, they were also here for a while as well. So I would say yes, Whitney Pier and other areas around the island would have been incredibly diverse.
Can you talk about some of your favorite collections at the Beaton Institute?
I get asked this question quite often about what your favorite collections are, and it varies all the time. And to be honest, we're having things donated constantly, and almost with every donation, there's a new favorite. I would say the favorite part of my job, I will speak to a few of the collections, but a favorite part of my job is connecting with people and connecting people with the cultural collections, with the heritage that they're looking for, with the information that they're looking for. I have to say right now we're working with some of our Gaelic holdings, and that's been really exciting. We have a Storrs Gully Cape Breton project that's ongoing through Dr. Heather Sparling. And some of these manuscript groups hold songs, that Gaelic songs, that maybe have never been heard before, or, you know, there's been a change to the lyrics or the tune so that it's specific to Cape Breton. And so they're trying to get a catalog of all the Gaelic songs in Nova Scotia, which is a monumental task. But I've been really excited and energized to see what they're finding within the holdings. And these things probably would have been hidden from researchers if we hadn't done this work, and if Heather Sparling and the Gaelic College hadn't signed on in the Highland Village to work together, to sort of tackle this work and to liberate these things from the archive. We're also working on another project that's really exciting, and I've enjoyed learning more about, I guess, our Indigenous collections and Indigenous communities on the island. And we're working right now with Dr. Rod Beresford on an oral history project about oysters. And so this has been interesting to go through the collections just to see what we have connected with the history and cultural significance of oyster farming on the island. And so that's been fascinating. But I have to say, one of my favorite archival collections as a whole would be our newspaper collections. I'm fascinated by what I find, in the different papers, because we used to have so many different papers over time. And, you know, from the 1840s onward, you can sort of get a sense of what life was like on the island just by going back through these both hard copy newspapers and newspapers on microfilm. It's really hard to pick one because, you know, the oral histories are also incredible. We received recently an amazing oral history collection that belonged to Len Stevenson from Dominion. And so those are being digitized right now, and those are hundreds of recordings of people from the area. And, you know, that's very exciting. Those haven't really been heard before, so I'm looking forward to going through those as well.
Do you think it's possible to get more young people involved with the activities there and to encourage them to be more interested in our local history?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's always our goal. Probably the most rewarding part of my job is working with students. And we're lucky to have, faculty and courses that actually use the archive on site, as well as having an internship program. And I love engaging with students and connecting them with collections and pieces of our history. And we also employ students. Right now we have, 9 project and student staff that are working here, and that's usually the case in the summer as well. And so while we don't get into classrooms as often, say in high schools, we do work with Heritage Fair. And many of the Heritage Fair projects, the students will come in and do their research. And I would like to see, the Beaten going out more into schools. But luckily, a lot of our material is online and, can be accessed at a distance. But absolutely, I mean, part of our mandate and our goal is to promote and provide access about the history of Cape Breton.
Can you share that story about a young person who was part of the Beaton Institute internship program that connects her with the late U.S. President Abraham Lincoln and Gettysburg?
Oh, right. Yeah. I recently published a little Arts at CBU piece in the Post, and we've been offering the internship now for about just over 10 years and have probably graduated over 20 students from the program. And every time we try to match collections and archival work with the interests of the student. And in this case, we had a student who was interested in archival photographs and photographic technique. And so we knew we had this beautiful collection from Nelson Rice, who is an amateur photographer from North Sydney. And we needed, more information about the photographs themselves. They were often individual portraits of people. We needed to, put more of the information online and, create archival descriptions around it. And so while you're doing that, part of the archival process is to do research into what you're looking at. You can't really write descriptions or talk about a collection unless you first research it. So the student, Susan, started to look into the Rice family and discovered that they were involved in all sorts of different, basically photographic businesses, and, you know, photography was a great passion for almost the entire family. So through just looking at Nelson's collection, she discovered that we held other collections from other Rice family members, and then there were also family members who became quite famous. And so Moses Rice was a photographer who ended up moving to the United States, and he worked with a fairly famous studio there. And although there's a lot of controversy whether he actually took the portrait of Abraham Lincoln or if it was his boss, but he is attributed to the photo, the Gettysburg portrait of Lincoln.
And how about George Rice? You briefly mentioned he was a resident of Victoria County and passed away up north back in the late 1800s.
So George Rice lived for a time in Bedeck, actually. And so between North Sydney and Bedeck, the family, that's where the family was primarily based, and then they moved around from there. But George Rice, unfortunately, he perished during the Arctic expedition, and that was the Greely expedition. So he was born in 1855, and he did die in the Arctic in 1884. They were unfortunately waiting for the arrival of a relief vessel. But there is a lot of information, probably more than the other Rice family members. There's more on George that we seem to find than the others. And of course, Moses is mentioned because of his connection with Abraham Lincoln. But I think the interesting part about this is that our intern, who previously had very little experience doing historical research or using primary sources, ended up completing a fairly extensive genealogy on the Rice family. She learned how to use multiple different research tools, such as microfilm, of course, online searching, and she reached out to people as well, so to actually, you know, call and talk to people to learn more. So I think the internship itself was really successful just because it really developed research skills for the intern. She was also so interested in the photography that she ended up, it was so sweet, she ended up purchasing a few Rice photographs and donating them to the archive as well. And she just came back to work at the Beaton on a small contract. So there's nice continuity there between the internship and, you know, future employment as well.
Your social media posts are getting a lot of traction online. Can you explain the engagement as of late when it comes to sharing a glimpse of our past on Facebook and Twitter and other social media accounts? It must be nice to see all the likes and the shares from people who live here. And some of those photos can really make you take a step back when you see places like Sydney, Glace Bay, Sydney Mines, and Escazoni back in the early days.
Yes, we're really proud of our social media presence. I have to say we waited until we had a social media policy. We thought out our approach to presenting our photographs. And for a time, we were very fortunate. We had a digital archivist who took care of the posts on a daily basis. So unfortunately, the regular posting has fallen off, but we're still trying to put up photographs and posts as we can. But as far as the likes, the engagement, the community information that we're getting, as well as being able to reach people who are maybe living away from Cape Breton and want that connection, we've been just thrilled. It's been one of our best outreach methods. It's been really successful, and we love, the staff and students love seeing the reaction from the public to the photos, and it's a nice way to share things that maybe aren't seen on a regular basis, or to connect with different events that are happening either in the community or at Cape Breton University. And so, you know, we hope in the future to be able to, you know, spend more time on the social media component at the archive, because we think it's really important. And, you know, we did expand at one time to Instagram, but have had to pull back a little. But we still post on Twitter and we post on Facebook as well. And we're really grateful for, you know, for the community to support us and, you know, all of our followers to be so engaged with the photographs. When we can, we try to take information, too, and correct it. And one of the most recent corrections that we're looking into is a very early 1880s photograph that we thought was in Sydney of a group of a Mi'kmaq family, but actually we've had information now telling us that it's potentially in St. Anne's, and it definitely makes sense that it would be St. Anne's. So, you know, at times we rely on this engagement and this feedback to help our records and to correct the historical record.
And finally, Jane, how can people learn more about the Beaton Institute, and are there any events coming up that you'd like to talk about? There are several comments online mentioning a very welcoming atmosphere there, and plenty of help is always available.
Sure. Well, definitely, if you go to beatoninstitute.com, that's going to allow you to look through some of our collections, and then we also have our CBU site as well. And on these two websites, you have different resources that will help you search the archive. It'll also give you updates on our opening and closing. So right now, we are closed to the public because we have major renovations happening on site, but we will be open soon. And we do, you know, we do take appointments as well. So you can either call the front desk at 563-1329, or you can email at beaton@cbu.ca to contact us, or my direct email is jane_arnold@cbu.ca. So those two sites are really useful. And I think we just want to get across that, you know, we are available to the community. And, you know, we encourage community members to use the resources here at the Beaton. And if there are any questions, always to get in touch. And that we are available to even go and speak to different communities and community organizations, which has happened in the past. And, of course, if anyone has any questions or interest in donating to the archive, we'd be more than happy to take a call or an email because we are actively collecting still as well.
Time now for The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. This week, broadcaster-writer Blaine Henshaw has published his third book entitled The Peddlers, stories about the door-to-door trade way back when in Nova Scotia.
The thing that really inspired me to write this particular book was something that happened when I was a kid. And I spent time with my grandparents down in Weymouth, in the western end of the province. Now, I'm talking back in the 1950s. And there was a guy who came around with a grocery truck. It was like a little store on the back of the pickup truck. And he sold dry goods and things to people out in the country. Keeping in mind, it was in the 50s when not everyone had a car. And there weren't supermarkets all over the place like there are now. But this guy's name was Freddie Manzer. And it's his picture that's on the cover of the book, by the way. But he used to come around to different communities, and he'd come to my grandparents' place, and my grandmother would go aboard the truck and buy the dry goods, the things that she needed, until the next time he came around. And I went aboard. I was fascinated with this idea of a store on wheels, and that stayed with me. And finally, many, many years after I had done my working career and retired, I decided that I would write this book. I've written three books, so I've published three books, and the three that I've written have all been inspired by things that happened when I was a young fellow growing up in rural Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. So it starts off with the story about the Fuller Brush Man, and which when I was reading it, I thought, why is that's the first chapter, and I thought, why is this guy in here? And then, lo and behold, Alfred Fuller came from Nova Scotia. And I don't many people know that. So, well, Tell our listeners a little bit about Alfred Fuller and how that became the basically multi-million-dollar industry it is or was many years.
Alfred Fuller was born and raised down on a little place called Wellsford, just outside of Berwick, Nova Scotia, in the Annapolis Valley. And he went to Massachusetts as a young man when he was 19, as a lot of Maritimers did. And he didn't get off to a very successful start. Within less than 2 years, he got fired from three jobs. And then finally, his fourth job was selling brushes for a brush manufacturer in Somerville, Massachusetts, near Boston. And he did quite well at that, and he stuck with that for quite a while. And then decided to branch out on his own because as he was going door-to-door selling brushes, he realized that some of the line of brushes that he sold, was a demand for brushes that were different shapes, different functions, and he didn't have them. So he started to design brushes on his own, and his sales increased because he would go to a house and perhaps they would want a brush for the chimneys of oil lamps, and that would be a particular shape, different size, that kind of thing. So he kind of tailored his brushes to what the market demanded. And the rest, as they say, is history. But Alfred Fuller was kind of the king of door-to-door salespeople. He started from very humble beginnings and built it into a multi-million-dollar industry all over North America. But he was born and raised and went to school right here in Nova Scotia. The house that he was born in is still standing in Wellsford. I've been there a couple of times. And while I was writing this book, I went there and interviewed his nephew, who at that time was 84 years old. And the interview is in the book, but he had some interesting things to say about Alfred Fuller. He built this huge empire of door-to-door salesmanship, but he came home to Nova Scotia practically every summer. He never forgot where he came from, and if you go down to Wellsford, where he was born and raised, he's also buried there. And he left money behind for the upkeep of the cemetery. He left money to Acadia University for a scholarship that exists to this day. So he contributed a lot to Nova Scotia. And his second wife was from Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. Her last name was Pelton. And the Pelton home in Yarmouth, after both Alfred Fuller and his wife passed on, was donated to the Yarmouth Historical Society, and it's part of the museum complex in Yarmouth. And there are a number of artifacts, a number of Fuller products on display in the Pelton House in Yarmouth.
Do you think Nova Scotians, many Nova Scotians, knew this story?
Oh, there were some Nova Scotians who knew it. People who were maybe baby boomers or a little older, they would have been aware to some extent. But there weren't a lot of people who knew. There were at the time when he was a young man, of course, lots of people knew. But those people died off, and successive generations wouldn't necessarily have known that one of the biggest door-to-door companies in the world originated with a guy from Nova Scotia.
Yeah, and
I doubt very much if any of the younger people today would know who Alfred Fuller was or that he was from Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a big deal, Fuller Brush. I mean, there were two movies made about it, or you know, they were called The Fuller Brush Man and The Fuller Brush Girl, right?
Yes. You
know, with the Red Skeleton and Lucille Ball and those. Do you know those movies?
I haven't seen those movies.
Yeah.
But I'm well aware of them.
Yeah, you mentioned them
in the
book.
I'm sure they're black and white movies.
Yeah.
They've been colorized. But,
right.
I'm sure they're black and white movies. And
yeah.
They would tell, if not the true story, close to the true story. I doubt if there'd be much reference to Fuller coming from Nova Scotia.
Right.
It would be more about the adventures of a salesman going door to door.
But it it shows you the you know, how big a deal it was if you're going to make, you know, two Hollywood movies over a couple of years about, like, a door-to-door
exactly.
brush salesperson, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. With, you know, pretty big-name stars at the time, right?
Sure.
Yeah. There's a the whole book is quite fascinating. Let's just talk a little bit more about so the Stanley Home Products. I think a lot of people know or have heard of those over the years, bought some of this stuff. This was a guy named Frank Stanley Beveridge, another Nova Scotian, right?
Yeah, he was from Yarmouth County, and he, at the beginning of his career, again, he moved to the United States, and at the beginning of his career, he worked with Fuller Brush, and he held a high position with the Fuller Brush Company for quite some time, and then decided to leave, and he and the lady who had been his secretary at Fuller Brush started their own company, and they used a different approach to sales. It started as door-to-door sales, but then they found that almost by accident, they learned that you could get a group of people together in some lady's home and make your sales pitch to a group, and that would save you going door-to-door. And sales would be much faster. So they started what became known as the house party system of sales. And that was, again, Stanley Home Products. And as you mentioned, Stanley, or his middle name was Stanley, his last name was Beveridge. He, too, was from Yarmouth County.
I know over the years my wife's been invited to some of these host party events, and they're, you know, for various things. They could be cosmetics.
Yeah, Tupperware is a popular one.
Tupperware and that, but... You're saying that it was Frank Stanley's, his wife and a group of ladies, they started that concept?
No, it wasn't his wife.
Or the secretary.
Started, one of the salesmen for Stanley Products, actually
right.
It was a guy in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And he went selling door to door, and he called on one of the local minister's homes. And the lady of the house was entertaining some of her friends that day, and she said, "I'm sorry, we don't have time for you to come in. I can't buy anything from you today." And he started to leave, and when he got halfway down the driveway, the lady came back and called him back, and she said, "I'll tell you what." She said, "We're trying to raise some money for my husband's church. If you will give us a portion of any of the sales that you make, you can come in and you can make your sales pitch to these ladies who are visiting with me today." So back he went, and he made a sales pitch to these ladies, sold a number of products, gave a commission to the lady for her husband's church, and that's how that party style of sales began, by that one call to a minister's home. It was not Beveridge himself who developed that type of sales, but one of his salespeople did, and Beveridge heard about it, and they further developed it, and it became the way of selling Stanley Home Products.
Copied and still going strong today?
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
So now this one, again, every chapter I was reading, I was thinking, really? Like Muscol was invented in a basement in New Glasgow?
Yes.
Come on, tell us about that one, Blaine.
Well, that was Charlie Call. He had worked for Lieber Brothers in the United States, and they were famous for their soap products. And he had some knowledge of chemistry, but I don't think he was a chemist. And then he came back to Nova Scotia. He was from the Glasgow area. He came back to Nova Scotia after working with Lieber Brothers in the States. And when he came back to Nova Scotia, he was trying to develop a product that would lure fish and deer and that kind of thing. He was an outdoorsman and a hunter and a sports fisherman, and he was trying to develop something that would lure fish and also deer. So he was doing this part-time in his basement because when he came back to Nova Scotia, he took a job in Stellarton with Tibbetts Paints. And it was while he was working on this part-time in the evenings in the mid-1950s, he registered a company. And what he, in fact, developed was an insect repellent. And it was, he kind of developed that almost by accident. But sports, some of his friends caught on to it, some of his sport fishing friends and hunters. He let them have some of what he had developed, and they found that it was it didn't attract fish or deer, but it it was a repellent, an insect repellent. And so he developed mescal was the name of the product.
Which, of course, almost anyone who's spent any time in the woods is, has either been told to put it on or put it on or bought it
or
in a store.
In their kit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's three Cape Bretoners in the book. There's a chapter on them. And these were, for all intents and purposes, these were true roadside peddlers, right? Who were they?
Yeah, they were pack peddlers. That's what they were known as, and they were called that because they carried packs, huge packs on their backs, and they were filled with clothing items and knickknacks, you know, that kind of thing. Cheap watches and jewelry and that kind of thing. And the ones in Cape Breton were Polish Jews for the most part. And they were very, very successful. They worked hard, and they did this year-round. And keep in mind, there certainly was no internet at that time. There were none of the big box stores. So the market was different then. And the best way to reach the market in those days, and we're talking 1930s and 40s and 50s, was to peddle door to door. So that's what they did. And one of the leading ones was Jack Yaser. He'd be probably the best example, and he became very successful. He came to Cape Breton basically penniless, couldn't speak English. He was 15 years old. He went to school for a very short time. He was in a class with a bunch of 6-7-year-old kids, and that was very difficult for him. So he learned his English by peddling, and he peddled all over Cape Breton. His life was a great success. On his way to Canada, and to Cape Breton, he had the boat that he came over on. Stopped in Quebec, and he was just a young fellow at this time. Keep in mind, he was about 15, and in Quebec, he saw a steward or a conductor helping a woman who had a couple of small kids, and she had all this luggage that she was having a hard time managing, and he witnessed this conductor helping this lady with the kids and with the baggage and everything. And that registered with him. It was a moment that stayed with him. And he promised himself at that point that once he got established in Canada, he would do whatever he could to help others. And that's how he lived his life. He got the Order of Canada. He got the Order of Nova Scotia. And he was also appointed a citizenship judge. And a citizenship judge is the judge who presides over the swearing-in of new Canadians. And that was a great honor for him. He lived to be over 100 years of age. And the thing that was most important to him, his proudest achievement, he said, was being appointed as a citizenship judge. Quite a story.
Yeah, Jack, familiar with Jack. My father, it was Sinclair McDougall. His first job as a young man was with Jack Yaser on Charlotte Street when the Yaser brothers finally opened the stores, and he worked there on and off for Jack for years. And it was, I remember it being, you know, just a little boy with my brother, and like, when my mother would take us uptown, it would always be neat going into, you know, going into Yazor Brothers, you know, you go in to visit Dad, but, I mean, the first guy over to say hello to you would be Jack, right? And he was just such a wonderful person. And then, like you said, he's done a lot for Sydney and Cape Breton in general. And then when he got older, he ended up living in the same assisted living place right across the hallway from my mother. So it was always kind of neat because he would tell many stories. He had his wits about him right to the end. He lived to be just past 101. And sports was another thing. He did a lot for promoting sports, baseball, sponsoring teams. And really neat man. But Dave Epstein, one of the other peddlers in Cape Breton Peddler from the book, you talk about that as well as how they were involved in community and sponsor things like that. You want to talk about Dave a little bit?
Yeah, he was quite athletic, and he supported a lot of sports teams in one way or another. And the story that's in the book that I enjoyed writing about was he did a walking contest, and I believe it was in the early 50s. In any case, it was won by an older lady who she had a family of seven, if I remember correctly.
Mrs. Corbett.
Yeah, and she lived on a farm, and the morning of this walking competition, she got up and milked the cows, took care of the family, then walked into town, and then took part in the walk, and she won. She was the first over the finish line, and that was an amazing thing. She won the trophy, and it was quite an event that he had sponsored. And that was the kind of thing that that he got involved in addition to his starting as a peddler and then getting into the retail stores.
The last year, the CBRM named a bicycle and walking trail on Grand Lake Road, the Mary Ann Corbett Trail, and the signage there.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. And that trophy is, there's a museum in New Waterford. It's usually mainly only open in the summer times, and and the trophy's there, and then the which is all pretty neat because you know having trophies made. And I've seen some of these older trophies that they don't look like they were just made on a shoestring. You know, there was a lot of you know, money
not
and expense.
Plastic in them.
No, there was no plastic in them. These are real trophies.
Right.
And these guys would, you know, foot the bill for them. And then the third of the peddlers is, well, first off, Yazor's and Epstein's, they became major clothing stores in Sydney for many years. And they're gone now. The Yazor building still has the sign on the name outside, but that's being taken over by somebody else shortly, I believe. But Spinner's, Moses Spinner, who started that store, the third of our peddlers, That store still exists. Scott McFarlane runs that store now. So you want to talk a little bit about Moses Spinner?
Yeah, and he was another one of the European peddlers who came over very young. And, you know, he peddled around Cape Breton summer and winter. This was before the stores became what they were, as big as they became. But his life had not been easy. If memory serves me correctly, he came from Poland, I believe. And he came when he was very young with very little money in his pocket. But he had some relatives in Cape Breton who had come over before. And he started with them, and they put him to work peddling. Right away, which was common not only in Cape Breton with people like that, but also on the mainland of Nova Scotia and also in New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island. But he began as a pack peddler. Again, he estimated that the pack sometimes weighed as much as 100 pounds. Now, these were young men. They were teenagers, really, 16 and 17 years of age. So that would be quite a burden for them, but they did it. And I believe he's the Cape Breton peddler who, in the book, I wrote about him saying how the straps that held the packs on their backs would chafe their arms and their shoulders, particularly in the summertime when they would sweat a lot. And, you know, they went through that kind of thing, keeping in mind there were no cars, well, there were cars, but they certainly didn't have them. And they walked door to door, and they would get their meals from people that they were peddling to, and sometimes they would barter. There was a lot of barter would go on in those days. They would go in and have a meal, and they would pay for the meal with a towel or a cake of soap or something like that. And if they were out for, you know, several days, they would actually stay with people on their peddling route. So that's how it was for all of those peddlers at that time.
It's hard to believe. No, if anybody said to a young person today, well, why don't you do this for the summer? We've got a pack, and we'll put something, I don't know, whatever, something interesting in it that people may want to buy. But the only thing, you can sell them all and make the money, but you have to carry it.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere you go.
Not very likely that they would take the job.
Not very likely at all, yeah.
No. Yeah. There are a couple of other stories in the book about peddlers on the mainland that are quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is about the late Lester Rogers. He was from Truro originally. He was a Raleigh salesman, and he was sent down to Lunenburg County. But he had a dream from the time he was a young man that someday he was going to have a radio station. And he is the man who was the founder of CKBW Radio in Bridgewater. That station went on the air in 1947, and it was the end result of a lot of work that Lester Rogers had done peddling throughout Lunenburg County. And he realized his dream, and that radio station is the radio station where myself, in 1966, started my broadcast career. And Mr. Rogers was still there at the time. But at the time, I didn't really know the full story. All I knew was that he was one of the founders of the station. And it was only when I wrote the book and interviewed his son, who was a colleague of mine, that I got the whole story. And he was the guy who virtually single-handedly brought radio to the South Shore of Nova Scotia.
A true radio pioneer.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and... speaking of radio, you you're still somewhat involved in radio.
Most of your staff there at the coast.
Mm-hmm.
I work at Seaside FM Radio, which is a community radio station in Eastern Passage. I'm a volunteer there. I'm on the air. Tuesday through Fridays in the afternoon, and
mm-hmm.
I also have a weekend show where I feature exclusively East Coast music on Seaside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for us old broadcasters, we love to work at community radio, because community radio is what I call real radio. It's the way radio was meant to be in the very beginning. People talk about interactive communication on the internet and all that kind of stuff, but community radio is truly interactive radio, because for the most part, most of the day, the programmers are on the air live, and the audience can call in and say, could you play this tune for me, or can you tell me what the weather is over here, or I've got a community bean supper going on, or there's a church event, and that can get on the air practically immediately. And I know that you do a good job at that there. Yeah. In Glace Bay. And I would encourage the listeners to your station to support the station, because community radio is giving you what the other stations don't want to give you anymore. And that's good live community programming.
Yep.
It'll tell you what's going on in your community.
Yeah, and they're telling it to you live. I mean, when I just think of some of the... like yourself, I do the volunteer work here with the on the dialogue show. But you know, the I mean, between Bill McNeil and Phil Thompson and Dave Wilson, the diehards at the station here, they may have 150 years of experience between them.
Well,
at least 40.
Yeah,
each.
Dave Wilson would have 150 years because he's getting old.
That's right, Dave alone. But I mean, it is truly neat, and there's a. it's always neat when you come into the studio and, you know, there's people, the staff milling about, and there's a vibrancy and there's something to it. And, you know, the people that do the news, they want to be on top of everything, and it's not coming from somewhere else. You know, there's something quite neat and different about it. So we've been talking to Blaine Henshaw, who's just written his third book, The Peddlers, subtitled The Fuller Brush Man, The Lords of Liniment, and Door-to-Door Heroes in Nova Scotia. The book is put out by Pottersfield Press. You can find it at many local Nova Scotia bookstores. The Curiosity Shop in Sydney carries it. You could buy it online as well, I am certain. It's a really lovely book. There is lots more interesting stuff in it. We touched on some of the key people, including the Cape Bretoners, and I'd encourage people to pick this up. Blaine, many thanks. And do you have the book there with you?
I've got the book right in front of me.
You want to? You want to finish off with maybe one nice good sentence.
Yeah, I'm going to give you, if I can, just a very short paragraph
okay.
from the book.
We're going for a good paragraph from Blaine Henshaw.
This is from chapter one. The first door was slammed in my face, said Nova Scotia-born Alfred C. Fuller, founder of the Fuller Brush Company. It was January 1905, and Fuller, then only 19, had just started his fourth job, selling brushes door-to-door in Somerville, Massachusetts.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.